You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this next segment is Rudy Gerson. Rudy, it's good to have you here.
Nice to be here, Eric.
And so, Rudy, we begin with a question where people roll their eyes. So who are you? But really what I mean by that is that where would you like to start the conversation? What story or labels or pieces of your life would you like to share as kind of the opening offer, the kind of the things, the stone that gets the ripple started in the pond?
Okay.
So that we can start putting together the different images.
Okay. I guess I'll start with a little bit about myself and then
We'll take it from there.
Yeah. I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a senior at Cornell studying performance. And I really love Ithaca. Last night I saw Big Mean Sound Machine for the 8th time or something. And I only saw them for the first time in May, and I stayed the summer here. And during that time, I came to really identify with this place and feel more at home here than at home in Las Vegas.
Right. What is it that makes you feel at home? I mean, that's the homeness. What is that for you here?
I guess I would say where I'm from in Las Vegas, there is not much intention with the local community and what they see as the proper way to live. There's not a lot of reflection and a real investment in the place. And,
right.
And maybe that's just the nature of who goes to Las Vegas. But in Ithaca, I find that, not that this place is flawless by any means.
Right.
People want to be here and want to improve the place and have a commitment to Ithaca and the people that live here, in a way that feels more at home than when I'm just driving around in the suburbs in Las Vegas.
Right. Well, Las Vegas was in the 90s, I believe, the fastest growing real estate market in the United States.
Yes,
and
sir.
So the bust hit it really hard. And there was kind of the only reflection was, how can we do more?
Yeah, they only had one way of, of operating.
Right.
That's exactly right.
Right. And here, you know, this is a small, in some ways it's a backwater. We have the largest, most prestigious research university that's most isolated in the U.S.
Okay.
There is no other major research university with the sort of prestige. The only one that's even close is Penn State, and it's closer to both Philadelphia and Pittsburgh than Ithaca is to New York or Buffalo.
Wow.
So it's, you know, we are isolated. So people who arrive here, if they don't like it, they didn't want to come here, they came here kicking and screaming, you know, they eventually find something to love about it and make a contribution here. That's been several of my guests' experience. But you found it this summer between your junior and senior year.
Well, I found it
before
in a more substantial way this summer, in a deeper way.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, actually, I came here looking for that and expecting that. And I visited Ithaca for the first time when I was in high school over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I only knew Ithaca in the summer.
In the summertime.
Yeah.
False advertising.
Yeah, to say the least, And not just false advertising, like weather-wise, but being a student here is very different than living here in the summer without the students here.
Right.
And I just couldn't emphasize that enough, how it literally felt like culture shock when students left and I had to kind of navigate this place without that organization.
Right. So you brought some music with you, and
I'm
going to suggest if you can put this into the player,
yeah,
then pick what you want to start with, and we will cut to some music. And
awesome.
Which one would you like to?
I'm going to play
begin with?
Just because I went to the show last night and they are my favorite local band. I'm going to play some Big Mean Sound Machine. This is from their new album, Contraband, Angriest Man in the World.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Rudy Gerson. And Rudy, you talked about having come to Cornell to sample it when you were in high school, coming out of Las Vegas, Nevada. How in the world does somebody come from Las Vegas to sample Cornell's summer program?
Yeah, well, my whole family is from the East Coast, New Jersey, mostly, and so since I was little, I would spend part of the summers coming back here just to visit family, so I always had some roots on the East Coast, and I actually never thought to go to school anywhere but the East Coast, and so I just, and that's also what really different, there's not a lot of people in Las Vegas who go east. It's always even west, California, the Northwest, that's kind of...
That's where they go.
That's where they go, or Arizona as well, it's definitely, this was quite the trek, but I wanted to change a pace, so one summer when we were here visiting family, we just rented a car and booked it up to Ithaca, and my mom actually went to IC, and
Was
the first time she had been back to Ithaca since graduating.
Wow.
So there is a poetic connection there.
And what do you study at Cornell?
I make my own major. It's called the College Scholar Program, and I'm combining anthropology, comparative literature, and performing arts. So the nexus of those is a discipline called performance studies or performance ethnography. And so it's some of the research method with anthropology doing ethnographic field work, but then it's also kind of theoretical comparative literature sides of things. And then the performing arts, you get actual performance and the theory behind performance studies as a discipline, which Cornell doesn't have. So it kind of was the only way I could do this kind of study would have been in this way.
So what subject areas, what specific topics have you looked at in your work?
Yeah, my work focuses very, very strictly on Ithaca, New York, and the different organizations on campus and off doing politically engaged theater, and so both activism on the one hand and art on another, and so how those two come together and on the stage and off the stage, whether that's using performance in a protest in the street. And so my research looks at those organizations and how they function within institutions, beside them, in opposition to them, and my experience personally as a researcher / participant, how I've had to navigate those dynamics
being... Right. Different organizational commitments and
organizational
identities.
Commitments, also like a commitment to being objective, but also a commitment to the project. And so how could a researcher have commitments to a project that they see as their peers, not as like just objects of study, but actual co-learning together. That's kind of what interests me the most.
So what kinds of projects have you worked on?
So the biggest one was actually this summer, Civic Ensemble's safety project. I worked on that all summer with them and into the fall. And I guess still now I would say I'm still working on it. Everyone who's part of the project and who probably saw the show is still working on it.
Right. We'll be working on it for the rest of their lives in some sense.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of the show, right? Like it's not just representation. It staged a community building process that we all engage in or choose not to engage in or whatever. But it was very much more real than some other types of theater, and that's kind of what interests me. And so that was one case study I did,
Safety was a play, was a process to create a play about community and police relationships. So it was intentionally bringing together all the different points of view that you wanted to study.
Yeah, it was. It definitely by no means is my project. This was the brainchild of Sarah and Godfrey and Jennifer and everyone at Civic Ensemble. But what is really great about that project was, as a cast member, I was respected as a not just a full participant but a full collaborator. And so we got to shape the project throughout it.
Right. As an actor in a civic theater production, as an actor, you're also a creator of the script. You don't just interpret somebody else's script.
Well, in a way, all of us kind of create the script that Civic is trying to stage. And so if you're trying to think of community engaged theater, then we're all engaged in some way. And so they just try to bring those stories together, mm-hmm. reflect it artistically, and they do provide a point of view about where it should go and how.
Mm-hmm. You were about to launch into other projects, but I wanted to take a short digression.
Oh, definitely.
To that one. So what are some of the other projects that you have worked on?
On campus, on Cornell's campus, there's a required program for new students. Every fall when they arrive, mm-hmm. it's called Tapestry of Possibilities, and it's run by a student organization called Ordinary People, which is a peer-to-peer educational social justice theater group mm-hmm. on campus, and we run Tapestry for 4,000 plus new students, and that is definitely different than safety, but it has similar aims to like eradicate oppression, microaggressions, and bring these issues to light for new students.
And okay, so can you describe what happened? Those 4,000 new students, in what size groups do you interact with them? What do you do?
We have I think 10 shows in the KIPP Theater over the course of the first week of school. So mm-hmm. show at 5, show at 6:30, and show at 8 or 8:30, mm-hmm. and so we 300 to 500 students in the KIPP. And most of the people in that troupe haven't performed for that many people. So as a performer, selfishly, amazing experience. And then as a writer, I get to stage some of my writing and our collaborative writing. Mm-hmm. A lot of mm-hmm. it was collaboratively written. And then as like an activist or leader on campus, the people who are in that show are seen throughout the year and become not role models, but people to identify with that have an investment in this types of work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what is it? What is it? You're trying to eradicate what is it? Racism and oppression and microaggression.
I think in the general sense, it's eradicate mm-hmm. oppression, and so it's really looking at that, and so racism comes into it, classism, mm-hmm. even majorism, which is pretty strong.
Who's the more significant major on campus, or the less?
Yeah, which reflects like larger societal phenomenons about value and capitalism and whatever. So it kind of it ranges, but it goes from demystifying self harm and understanding it, and not just making it this distance other, but trying to grapple with that. We had some skits about sexuality, and so it kind of it tries to just provide a swath of different things.
Right. So these are issues about which students could be in some sense in conflict.
Yeah, or for the most part, have no position at all. A lot of people come in without just not really experience it for no fault of their own, mm-hmm, just mm-hmm. not really grappling with these things, which we, of course, stage it dramatically in your face, and so it's, of course, a little more insidious and shadowed in the real world, but we try to provide a humorous but also realistic portrayal of these things just to get the conversation started, and that's been a point of improvement that we could improve upon is making it a year-long, consistent thing that this group can be a peer-to-peer group that integrates diversity programming and community engagement throughout the year. And that's mm-hmm. kind of where my thesis work and my academic work transforms into actual practical work that can and should be done on Cornell's campus, as I see it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this is for a conversation later in terms of a whole host of differences and how to raise those. What I'm curious about is how sometimes when you have a difference in power with another person, the experience of power isn't always oppression, but sometimes it is. And how do you get people to become sensitive to the power of others, their own power, and then assessing whether this is an injustice or whether this is just this is the way it is in this particular setting, and it would be different in another setting or another stage of life.
Yeah. I think, I don't know what you are like gesturing towards, but the way I
have nothing specific in
perfect,
mind.
Perfect.
Yeah. I mean, this is a totally open-ended question. There's no hidden agenda on this one except to problematize power and oppression.
Yeah. The way I heard that statement is, in a way about agency and collective agency and Marx called it class consciousness, but it could just be about consciousness raising, which has a whole kind of, it's not the 60s consciousness raising that I'm talking about.
Right.
It's more about what structures of power are operating in this context. And so what Cornell and higher education across the country does really well is obscure that and make students not really see and identify with each other as agents of change and collective agents of change. And so what we might see as power that's outside of us, we kind of reproduce it. And so your statement a little bit brings that into play for
me. Sure.
And so that's kind of what we do. That's the work that we try to do, I suppose.
To make people more conscious of the power they have or the power that they attribute to other people.
The power that they could have.
Right.
And the power that each can bring to each other. So the power in numbers, but also just the seizing of power that's possible, which transitions nicely into the third study that I did, which is with some activism last semester around TCAT and the funding of the TCAT, where Cornell wouldn't increase their subsidy. And by Cornell, I don't mean the university. I mean like a very specific administrative department, the budgeting department, and a bunch of other administrators kind of refused to increase the subsidy. And so we used some performance in that campaign, in that organizing and escalation. And so looking at that too.
And so how did you choose to escalate in a way that wouldn't shut it down?
Yeah.
You've got to raise people, you got to raise an issue enough that it gets seen, but not so much that it gets dismissed.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's where kind of performance was designed strategically. And so we organized a mock bake sale, which was one of them. And so they said, oh, TCAT, like, they'll figure it out. They're entrepreneurs. Like, they'll raise the money. It's like $500,000. Or they'll say the students will figure it out. Kind of this, like, diffusion of responsibility onto the liberal philanthropic students. Like, they didn't have the money themselves. And so what we did was design this mock bake sale where we handed out cookies to people. Instead of selling the cookies, we'd say, we're going to sell cookies to get $500,000 for TCAT. Of course we didn't. We handed cookies to people, and they called President Scorton's office and demanded that he and his crew increase funding. And so that was one, that's a performative gesture, which makes the news a lot better as well.
Right. And it's also a gesture that's based on a sense of reciprocity. You get the cookie, you make the call.
Yeah.
And that's a tit for tat way of being in community, which is one technique.
Exactly.
One technique. And a place that operates on money and status, that's the way it works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it does. But it also kind of breaks a little bit of that logic by giving people's cookies and just asking for a phone call. And there was an educational component. Most people we talked to, including myself before we designed this, I didn't know you could call President Scorton's office and like he'll get they will record what your complaint was. And so the act of calling President Scorton, who we think we are indebted to, who we think we need to respect and defer to for all our decisions, he in some ways should be answering to the students in a little bit, not in like a...
Right, and it's not about deference. Respect isn't about deference, but when it's used in a context like that, then it is a one down.
Yeah, thing. So students, the act of calling is a little bit transformative for people to be able to call President Scorton's office and say, I think you should do this. Like people thought that was really, really transgressive and really out of line, when in fact that's kind of our rights, and that's why he set up the system, or that's why the systems have these things set up so that you can
and in a
have
certain
free speech.
Sense, right, and in a certain sense, to his credit, because I've called provosts and presidents and, you know, in both institutions and actually, you know, not always gotten a response in any timely fashion, but usually and within some time, it's there if people wish to take it. It's not that it's being withheld. It's often a failure of our imagination to use the power that we have.
Yeah.
Could have.
Yeah, we're not really told we're supposed to call the president's office when we have an issue. It's not something we imagine. We have homework to do, and we have awards to win or
and
whatever.
An individual call is not the same as a concerted 50, 100, 200 more calls coming in on the same topic. And,
yep.
then it rises to the level of attention.
There's an act whenever we're all doing it together on Hope Plaza. Yeah,
absolutely.
That's
absolutely.
Right.
Do you want to? What music would you like to cut to next?
I can play for... Right now, I'm feeling there's this band, Adult Jazz, and they're from the United Kingdom somewhere, and I have a song on here from their new record called Gist Is. It's called Am Gone.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca.
Thank you.
This is Adult Jazz of Am Gone from an album Just Is. And our guest on this hour is Rudy Gerson. And Rudy, I want to kind of follow up with some... when you were in the play Safety, which is about community and police relationships, what did you learn? What did you learn that surprised you that you would never have thought you would have learned? And what did you learn that confirmed everything you thought? I push it in those divergent ways because that kind of helps us get at it.
The thing I learned that most surprised me, I guess the most unexpected part of that project, was how what full participation looks like. And the ethics of that and the emotions of that too. And so as someone who's coming from Cornell, who is white, who hasn't had much interaction with the police, that wasn't really me just being a dumb kid or inciting them for the most part. Me also being interested in this topic, like professionally and also academically, when I arrived in the cast, the 10 or 12 people that started, I thought, here's how I should check my privilege. I should just be quiet and just listen to people and let them speak. Because I don't know where other people are coming from.
And you don't want to overwhelm them with your privilege on some level.
That, and I didn't want to like be in charge. No matter what my experience was. Then there came a point where Sarah, the artistic director of Civic Ensemble, or maybe Civic Engagement Director.
She's the director of Civic Engagement for Civic Ensemble.
Yes, that's exactly it. And so she pulled me aside after one of the rehearsals and was like, basically told me, Rudy, I know you have thoughts. Why aren't you speaking? Or you really should speak up.
Right.
And then I protested with like, no, I want to give people their space, and so with kind of that response, and she said, that's not why you're here. Like, you have just as much to provide as anyone. And so what basically really surprised me about that project is how I was feeling guilty that I was privileged, but I still was there, which almost translated into like pity for other people.
But also pity for yourself. And
pity for myself. What like respect looked like was actually a full participation and respecting everyone as equals or as peers in a way that I would respect anyone else who I considered my peer. And so not trying to like create these hierarchies in my mind of like when's the right time to speak, but just, we're all in it together, basically.
Right, right. And one of the things that what I'm going to hear in what you just said, and you tell me if I'm barking up the wrong tree or whatever. One of the things about when you're in a community where equality is the goal or perhaps the norm, and well, let's say it's the goal because it's rarely the norm. If you don't live out loud, you're not part of that community.
Yeah.
And yet if you live out loud, what you say is going to be heard in tons of different ways based on people's privilege or assumptions of privilege or whatever. But the commitment is to the conflict, and that the conflict will be productive. And that's why earlier in the show I asked about what's the difference between power and oppression. Because power brings us into conflictual relationships where the friction is productive. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But oppression, you know, the friction is not productive.
Yeah.
It's not at all productive.
Yeah. So that does make sense, because the cast, over the course of weeks, we saw each other weekly, multiple times a week, and we built a relationship, and we were all in it together to make this play and to learn about each other. And so if one day someone said something that ticked someone off, we knew we'd come back tomorrow, and we could see the whole of a person that you don't get to see sometimes. When someone makes an offhand comment, you just assume, oh, that person's X, Y, or Z, instead of investigating why they said that and giving them the benefit of the doubt that they're kind of in it to win it as well.
Right, or win it with everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what you just said that was so important, and we could trust that we could come back the next day.
Yeah.
Because most of those issues are not productively dealt with in the moment. There needs to be a a distance or a cooling off or just a slight perspective shift. Because if I can be such an intense person, I'll follow up with the boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
But oftentimes, turning away and coming back another time allows things to emerge. But it takes trust.
Yeah.
That you don't have to address something exactly when it happens.
That's not to say, though, that like rage and anger aren't fueled in a really valid way and should be expressed. Right. But it also, I think, both of them work together. So
rage is raw expression, which does not bear reflection. Anger is a signal emotion, and it tells us something's wrong, and we have to figure out. It's not the solution, but it tells us we need to be aware that there's a problem here, and we need to address it.
Yeah.
Rage is beyond that ability to reflect, and that's where that's where you just try to make it as safe as possible for those around.
Yeah. So that's, I guess, I learned about that, and so learned what that looked like: full participation and respect. And then what I guess confirmed my beliefs. I don't know. I guess I always had a hunch that the power of these types of organizations, I always kind of thought that using theater in this way could be transformative, but I never felt it. I knew that it was a fact, but I didn't know how it was a fact. I guess that type of knowledge was intellectual, but the emotion that brings is something that was confirmed, but I never had felt before. I learned that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. We had a little bit of a conversation when the cast of Safety was on the show.
Yeah.
But I don't know if this particular piece actually made it on air, because we had some off-air conversations.
Uh-huh.
And it had to do when people are really interacting with each other from a place of honesty that neither puffs themselves up with a rage that's not proportional to the moment, or an anger, but also doesn't hold back.
Yeah.
But does not seek to harm, but also does not seek to restrain and induce self-harm. When people are like that, that is a space where really honest communication is happening, and the pain is honored, as well as the hope and all of the dreams get expressed and honored. And I called that, because my own background in theater came in seminary, that's what worship is at its best, is where people put out there what they both really fear and what they really hope for, and they try to figure out as a community, what can we do to get there? What's in the way? What do we need to set aside as wrongheaded or misguided or not helpful? And what do we need to do more of that we haven't yet valued? And it's not about spooky beliefs and not about the invocation of a power, but there is a power that comes into a process like that feels like it comes in from outside.
Yeah, as someone who studied anthropology, sure. I'm sure you've studied those types of ritual processes like that, and it's a very real power that it doesn't have to be ascribed mystical or magical.
Not magical, yes.
Yeah, it's
yes,
not magical. Yeah, it's collective and human.
Yeah. And that is what inspired me to study anthropology and ritual, and to continue it in a seminary where anthropology was a large part of the curriculum.
Yeah. Wow.
That's
cool.
So, but what I'm. What kind? This is all by way of kind of wanting to ask you, where do you see your work headed? Because
in the future,
to do this kind of work, which brings people into these relationships, it's a little volatile. It's emotionally. We've talked about how things need to be physically to have a physical integrity and grounding, and an emotional honesty, and be intellectually accurate for them to feel true. To have the weight, and that's kind of what you're striving for, I think, in these engagements. Where do you see yourself going, you know, after graduation? What's the next kind of step or
well, October, November 2015, I've got a plane flight that will be booked whenever it's cheapest to Guatemala to study Spanish for a month at a language school run by these revolutionary leftist artists and politicians, or ex combatants, I guess, and who teach a radical history of Guatemala and Spanish. And so I'm going to travel Latin America and Central America and get my Spanish down real well.
Okay, and then what's the purpose of getting your Spanish down well?
I don't know. It's just it's calling to me mm-hmm. that I need to be able to converse in Spanish. So I'm going to do it. And so there's also a lot of theater in Latin America mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Central America. Sure, sure. And so I'm going to do a blog and try to see a lot of theater because they do theater with a little bit more basic structures. Like they could do theater out of a coffee house and that's almost a little bit more common there. And mm-hmm. their theater is a little more politically engaged than the standard theater in America. And so I think I'm going to learn a lot from that. And so, but between now and then, I actually decided recently I'm going to stay in Ithaca again this summer mm-hmm. and work maybe Moosewood or get a bartending job or something. Right. And I actually might try to continue my thesis research and provide a report to the university. And there's a lot of cross-campus initiatives to actually integrate the things that my thesis integrates. And I might be able to continue that and work with some administrators to actually distribute resources to support this work that I think is important on campus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good. Good. I'm going to suggest let's take you brought two more songs with you. Let's go to one of them and then okay. we'll close on the other one.
Yeah.
And then we'll have a conversation in between.
Okay. This next song is by Spoon, and it's off their new album, They Want My Soul, and it is Let Me Be Mine.
You love it will come back sometime. Lock it up, what you love, and it says let me be mine. Oh, auction off what you love, it will come back sometime. Lock it up, what you love, and it says let me be mine. Let me be mine.
Our guest on this hour has been Rudy Gerson. Rudy, I'm going to, most of my questions, I'm beginning to learn how to frame questions of meaning and of weight in younger people's lives. And I don't, and that's just, it's different when you're 50 or 60.
Yeah.
As opposed to when you're 20 or 25. So if you can imagine looking back on your life when you're 70, 80 years old, What kinds of relationships would you have liked to have had? What kind of impact in the lives of the people around you and the communities you care about? What do you feel like now is the important thing that you're living toward? And I frame it in the looking back technique, which is actually, you know, Edward Bellamy wrote a book called Looking Back in the late 1800s, where he projected himself to 2000 and looked back, I think, to 1900 or something like that in the U.S. But it helps us to kind of think about what's important and what the steps might look like to make it happen.
Before I answer,
sure,
I'll just say thank you for asking that, because a lot of the adults in my life are asking me, what do you want to do with your life, in a judgmental, forward-looking way that actually doesn't really ask me, what are your interests, what do you want to explore, what are your goals,
what are your values?
They don't really ask me that question. And so This is a conversation for all you listeners out there. This is a good way to ask, like, what a young person should be thinking about moving forward that is actually enjoyable. And I'm going to learn by this answer.
Well, I can tell you that I've gotten better at it because I've been so inept at it with my own children who are 20 and 25.
So. Okay. So looking back on my life, I guess I would like to start something that outlives me, whether that's a theater company or a music festival or a farm. I want to create something that my vision could be instituted wholly and that it, I don't know. It's a hard question.
You want to leave a legacy and not just kids.
I don't even know if I want kids, to be honest. It's more like the peers and from a community. I want to feel like I'm part of a community and that I am committed to that community. And I also would like to work professionally as a theater practitioner. That's another goal of mine. And so within that goal, there lies a lot of values in that, and I think the type of theater practitioner I want to be is one that values collaboration and mutual support. And so I think for the most part, that could be how most practitioners practice. But I'm not going into this field for cutthroat. Competition or fame. It's more of a communal aspect.
Right. And if you go in it and the kind of with your own selling yourself as a product, there are not a lot of people who make it.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you see it as a relationship, what are the kinds of contexts in which you would see yourself living where theater would be part of your community?
Yeah, I think.
Or something that you do alongside
other work. I think, honestly, maybe I don't have that much exposure, but Civic Ensemble has been a real model and role model for what that would look like and how it integrates life with art and how it's really trying, the organization is trying to build a way of being and way of relating. And so, that's a tough question because it's so context specific that I have never thought of these questions outside of Ithaca, I suppose.
Right.
It's really the place that I've matured and learned about that this is what I want, at least right now. And so
what I have learned from studying people in my own doctoral work who came to have an intentional impact on the justice and the wealth and the well-being of their neighborhoods, some of the poorest neighborhoods in the U.S. in Detroit, Chicago, and New York, was that it took 5 to 10 years for them to become established in a community doing things that mattered.
Yeah.
And to be trusted. It took another 5 to 10 years to do anything that really mattered. And it took another 5 to 10 years to create something that would exist beyond them, that would continue to evolve but be an institution or an organization or a way of being in community that would endure past their span of leadership or their lives.
Whoa.
So we're talking about a 15 to 30 year commitment. in a particular place, with the ups and downs of relationships. But that was the piece of profound learning for me, is that these things involve making, you live your way almost inadvertently into commitments that have implications.
Yeah. There's in saying that, there's also something that I'm kind of drawn to just sitting here now. Mm-hmm. I could see myself teaching. I think a lot of my interests and a lot of the values that I think that I would want to spread and, mm-hmm. and hold and continue could be embodied teaching. I'm indebted to a lot of the people that have mm-hmm. taught me and mentored me. And right. so that reciprocity, I think, could exist alongside other pursuits.
Right. And what kind of teaching would you have in mind?
I haven't left school yet, but I could see myself missing the university setting. Mm-hmm. Definitely not this one as of right now, given there's a lot of what I feel like higher education is moving towards is not really funding teaching and not really caring about teaching. So I would have to see whether at maybe a smaller school or a different school, they would be able to support, like, with resources and the culture of the place, support the type of teaching I would want.
They have a $50 million to try to shift the way teaching is happening at Cornell now through an engaged learning initiative. But that speaks more to the distance they have to go to get there than where they are now.
And a lot of what the work for that has done already is really just administrative and kind of this top-down leadership that if mm-hmm. they have reports and committees, but I don't know, at least in my experience, mm-hmm. no one's really asked the students what that's going to look like. And so I think that's the next step, is how do we create structures for the faculty actually feel ownership of this mm-hmm. engaged Cornell, and that the students feel ownership, and that it's not just another kind of Band-Aid on the operating procedure. Yeah.
And it may be, I mean, large institutions often can't change from within.
Yeah, right.
And so there needs to be an organization that comes outside. We've talked about Civic Ensemble as one. It's outside conventional theater.
Yeah.
It's outside the institution of Cornell. Uh-huh. But also in Shared Journeys, we try to function in that same way as being partners with, collaborators with, but outside the formal institutional hierarchies and
that's,
stuff.
That's exactly right. Like, Engage Cornell, from what I don't know how many community members in Ithaca have been invited to these meetings to, like, shape what does a good ethical community partnership look like. And so I think that's the next step if they want to actually take that mission seriously.
Right. And the people who tend to get invited are people who are already organizational leaders rather than people who are known as being really just profound people.
Well, yeah.
And that's where Civic Ensemble or the Civic Theater that you're doing can help highlight people who are adept at responding to really complex things in complex ways.
Yeah, there's a notion, I think, in folklore called community scholars. And so it's the people in Ithaca that are the scholars of Ithaca, so to speak, mm-hmm. who know the people, know the history, mm-hmm. are kind of social centers. Those are the people that need to be propped up and respected as equal partners.
Right. And I think people here one group calls them natural leaders, informal leaders.
Uh-huh.
Gramsci called them organic intellectuals. You know, there's a history, this is really, really neat. So
yeah.
what briefly, because we're about to run out of time, what do you do kind of as a student to kind of restore your sense of balance and optimism and strength on a daily basis or weekly basis? Because being in school can be hard.
Yeah.
And being, you know, it's a trauma to leave everybody you know and come someplace new. It's also a wonderful time, but it's both. How have you found yourself taking care of yourself?
I make it downtown once or twice a week at the least. And so I find that distance helps a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Mighty Yoga downtown. I have a work trade arrangement. So every week I go in there, sweep the floors, and they give me a free yoga class. And so I help out 15 minutes on either end of the class,
sure,
probably less, and then get the class. And so that's always great for me.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it has been just continuing the work I started in the summer, and just kind of that momentum. It's a lot of been just I've built up a lifestyle in the summer here that I've tried to just maintain, whether that's exercising.
What is exercise? Okay.
Yeah. Exercising, not too regularly, but enough.
Huh. You only have to do it 2 or 3 times a week to keep your body. Yeah.
Yeah, and then a lot of it actually has been making connections and relationships with people who are not undergraduates mm-hmm. in my immediate social center. And so whether that's getting dinner with a friend downtown, like a man, not a student, not a friend, not a kid, just a person in a different part of their life. Or mm-hmm. there's another man, like John Suter, who his name's big around town.
Right.
I get food with him sometimes and talk with him continually. So like these types of things that remind me that what I'm doing at Cornell as a senior with my peers is not the only thing that matters.
Right.
I think those are the things that enliven me.
They keep life in perspective because Cornell can be overwhelming when you're.
Yeah.
There. Yeah.
And so, and also my art, I'll just say like acting and mm-hmm. acting and writing, that is something that is always so difficult and exhausting during it. But, there is definitely, the effort's worthwhile.
Our guest, Rudy Gerson, it's been good to get to know you.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me on.
And what's the last song? We're going to get a minute of it or a few seconds of it before we close.
The last song is by Driftwood, another local-ish band. And we're one block down from Buffalo Street, so this one's called Buffalo Street.
Thank you, Rudy.
Yep.
WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this has been the Made of Clay Report, and we are going to cut to Explorations Weekly, and you've been listening to Driftwood and Buffalo Street.